Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, back from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, but still carrying a conference cold. You can listen to me live 10 till 1, Monday to Friday, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. But you know that already. Coming up on today's episode, we're just going to put all the party conference stuff to one side, because there's been quite a lot of that. We know that. I've had a really, really fascinating tour of the old War Office building on Whitehall. It opened in 1906. It's where the First and the Second World Wars were fought. From the boardrooms, the offices, and the little spy corridors. And then in the 1960s, it was shut up. It's been behind hoardings ever since. It's now been turned into an amazing hotel. And I got a tour to be able to hear that in just a moment. So we'll do that. But first, it's time for these two.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
And Manveen Rana's here. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
And this week's Matthew is Matthew Powis. Hello, oh, Matthew Powis. Hello. I feel like we need to rename this feature to What's Manveen Brought In This Week, which is delicious. So we've had donuts for the last few weeks,
but this is
an upgrade.
I thought we were bored of donuts.
So what
is
this?
It's an upgrade. Are we calling it an upgrade? That's brave. I baked.
Of course it's an upgrade. You made it yourself.
I mean, you say that. I don't think it's as good as a professional donut.
This is nice, though.
It's cake.
So it's cake with raspberries in it.
With raspberries in
and
it. And a bit of amaretti biscuit.
Well, there we are.
Is it ultra-high processed, do you think?
Well, I made it, so no. I think if you bought it, it would be.
Have you not had any, Matthew?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, of course.
No, I will find out in 10 seconds.
There were two explanations. Either you didn't like raspberries, or you've already had it.
Or you tried my baking before, I don't know.
Lovely.
Mm. No, we look forward to that. I'm looking forward to Matthew. Did you bake, Matthew?
Of course not.
It's just saying, the reason I didn't do a bake one was because I'd be found out.
That's
Can you imagine
true,
doing one for Matthew?
Yeah. Maybe we should have a bake-well bake-off.
The important thing to know, it's a pudding,
yes,
not a tart. That's Mr. Kipling, the tart.
Yeah.
But the bake-well pudding is a pudding, and it's lovely and sloshy, and it's got jam and things in it.
I mean, this sounds like a future Thursday
feature,
morning,
though.
I reckon.
Yes. Was Bakewell actually in your seat, in your constituency
very
when
much
you were
so,
MP?
Yeah,
very good. Right, go on then, let's put the cake away and talk about Ukraine. So this interesting thing, that Kevin McCarthy's been removed as the Speaker of the House in America. It's the first time ever it's happened before. And one of the big dividing lines in politics in America now seems to be, do we want to help Ukraine or not? And that's... There's a big sort of, you know, it's just joined every other dividing line in America. But given that every dividing line in America eventually comes here, do you think it will, Maverick?
Oh, I don't know. I think our attitude has been very different to the Americans. I mean, I think America, to be honest, when the war first broke out, was very pro-Ukraine. But, you know, this incident, Kevin McCarthy, the only reason he was removed was because they, you know, some Republicans thought there was a secret deal over Ukraine and that would be crossing the line because, as they pointed out, within the Republican Party now, that is no longer a popular move. And, you know, I think if I was sitting in Kyiv, I'd be very worried that if Donald Trump wins the next election, there is no guarantee that there will be any more funding. If anything, I think we could all guess that'll stop. Yeah. You know, the last time he was president, he stopped funding to Ukraine. That was before the war. But you know, he has never expressed any great support for them. I think that's going to be over. And the problem is, American society is so fractured. They follow Trump, and you start to see it all over social media now. There's all this sort of conspiracy theories about corruption and where the aid money is going. And, you know, it's right to ask questions, but it feels like they've already decided without doing any of the work. And I think that can travel. You know, we're seeing it in bits of Europe. Slovakia has just had an election. The president, you know, won on the ticket of saying not one more bullet will be sent to Ukraine. Poland has one in 2 weeks. Again, there's suddenly ramping up of Ukrainian aid rhetoric, which is really alarming. And I think for us, you know, we are still very supportive, but we were never providing the bulk of the aid. I think that's going to leave us in a really difficult position if other people start to pull aid from the army's going over.
That's the point. We really have no agency in this. If the Americans pull out, the whole thing is over. I think this Congress thing is a bit of a hiccup, but if it's a straw in the wind,
yeah, exactly.
And if Trump gets in, I don't think that will ever take root in Britain. I think Britain, well, for a start, we're a lot closer to Ukraine.
Well, that's the other thing, in a way, the surprise has been that Joe Biden has held the line. So, because ultimately, Ukraine's a lot further away from America than it is from us, and the politics of America is so stung by Iraq and Afghanistan, and for older Americans, Vietnam as well. This whole idea of being constantly embroiled in expensive conflicts a long way away.
Well, think how long it took to draw America into the Second World War, instance.
Yeah.
Although, you know, if you think about the Republican Party, they were the ones who, a couple of years ago, you would have thought said, hadn't quite realised the Cold War had ended, and now you can't get them interested in it again. And I know they've had Iraq and Afghanistan, expensive wars that have cost them a lot of people too. But this is a war somebody else is fighting. It's kind of cheap at twice the price. You know, they're only providing kit, and they're getting rid of Russia as sort of a proper threat for at least a generation, but it doesn't feel like anyone's really making the case in America very well. There's a real fear that if they do pull the plug, I'm not sure how a dozen tanks are really going to make the tiniest bit of difference.
And actually, this is a reminder that despite all of the publicity and hullabaloo that Boris Johnson and then Rishi Sunak has tried to create before, that Britain's role is not as significant. It might be good for photo opportunities, but Matthew, you've presented me with a picture of a pudding. Explain what this has got to do with the geopolitics of support for Ukraine.
Well, it does, and that pudding is in Kyiv as we speak. And a friend of mine is too, and sent me a WhatsApp with a picture of the pudding that he had just encountered in a cafe just close to the Ukrainian Secret Service. And the pudding is called the croissant Boris Johnson UK.
In case you confused it for any other Boris Johnson.
And on the menu, it says, inspired by the English apple pie and our mutual favourite's adorable hairstyle, dedicated to our British friends in thanks for their support in the war against Russia. It doesn't actually look very much like Boris.
Well,
I
have to say, I feel like I've been had. Because when I read your notebook of the paper, Matthew, you said, it's bearing a tray, well, it looks like a dollop of straw-coloured ice cream on top of a sort of meringue with custard pastry, egg yolk and a bit of apple. And I was picturing something circular with some hair and maybe some eyes and a mouth.
Yes, yeah. You could do that. They can make hair, can't they? Like you spin
the hair is
sugar out.
So it's a sort of square pastry.
Yeah.
And then it's got meringue on it, which has been sort of piped on in a sort of squiggly mess. So actually, if you put it around that way, it's slightly better. And then you blowtorch it, don't you? So it looks like so it's burnt. And then there's a dollop of ice cream on top. Well, actually, if you drew eyes on the... I'm going to do that.
Yes.
If we drew our eyes on...
This segment is going to turn into Bake Off.
Now it's Boris.
It's completely making sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That makes total sense now. That's definitely Boris Johnson.
I'm not sure I'd want to eat something that looked like Boris Johnson.
No.
I'm not sure that's a winner on a menu.
I'll tell you, we would eat it. Boris Johnson. If there's a man who'd want to eat a pudding of himself,
four-course meal of himself.
But it's a reminder that, you know, you probably wouldn't get one of those served in wherever it is in Oxfordshire he's currently living.
No, you wouldn't. No, it is a reminder that not everybody sees him as I, for instance, do.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe he can, maybe a whole range of political, maybe that's what we should do. Maybe do that on the show tomorrow. We'll do politicians as puddings. Write that down. We'll make a note of that. We'll definitely make a note of that. Well, let's talk about the prospect of anybody making a pudding of Rishi Sunak. Here's a little bit of his speech from yesterday.
I am proud to be the first British Asian Prime Minister, but you know what? I'm even prouder that it's just not a big deal.
Now, this bit leapt out to me as being, because it is a reminder that something not happening is often as significant as something happening, that a big blow-up row, national debate is... Mm. And it actually seemed quite almost emotional. And this is not a man, you know, given that he is... was it John Coleshaw said to me earlier in the week, is close to being an AI bot while still being a human?
He does normally sound very robotic.
But he sounded quite emotional when he was doing that bit.
I think he may have been taking some speech lessons, but because the voice was a little lower and it lost that kind of wheedling edge that you often get with his voice. And I think he felt it. You must, you know, if you have succeeded and if everybody just keeps talking about you as being Asian, what do you feel? You feel, can't we move on from this? And I think he feels proud to think that he has moved on from it. And I think he has, hasn't he?
I mean, you know, when he was elected, it wasn't the same as Obama being elected in America, where, you know, you had this great moment.
Because, crucially, nobody voted for him.
I mean, there is that. Nobody voted. In fact, they voted against him.
Yeah.
The grassroots of the party voted against him, but he still managed to get there. Whereas, you know, when Obama sort of came to power, there was this great moment of America's had this complex relationship with race. This is the moment it's all going to be solved, even if it wasn't. I don't think there was any of that great hope. And you're right, maybe it's because he wasn't elected.
If he'd been the leader of the opposition, and then Britain had voted for its first non-white,
that would have been different.
Prime Minister.
I think also, though,
he just sort of was just there when everyone else.
Yeah, but also he said it. And at the same time, mentioned several times in his speech that the Conservative parties were, the Conservative Party was the one that had...
Yes, it wasn't a big deal, but
it wasn't a big deal until he mentioned it again and again and again. And I just, I don't know. I wasn't sure what the broader point was. You know, I don't think politics is suddenly in a post-race era because, you know, at the same time you had Suella Braverman standing up you know, on the same conference stage using, you know, the language of xenophobia to try and win a few points.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sort of think we'd be properly post-race if you could just have a politician of colour who wasn't going to have to stand up and talk about how you had to control immigration all the time, whereas it feels like that's the only way you tend to do well as a politician of colour at the moment, is to stand up and say, I'm all right, but honestly, I get why you should be worried about what everyone else, and I think that's very uncomfortable.
But you're of Asian origin, Manveen. How did it strike you at the point when you heard it, as opposed to us all talking about it now? Did you think yes, or did you think
Yeah, I mean, I recognised it. You know, there wasn't a great sort of moment when Rishi Sunak suddenly became Prime Minister. There wasn't a great moment of thinking, oh, look, this is a huge leap for a community or anything like that. And I think that's probably healthy in many ways. I think, you know, you want to be able to think you live in a society where you judge politicians on their policies rather than anything else. And, you know, I thought that was fine. I just thought, I found a lot of his speech slightly uncomfortable because he kept saying, you know, we are the party that has allowed this to happen. I am living proof that this is a country that isn't racist, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think he is evidence that we have come on leaps and bounds. But I think his party also has a very unhealthy attitude towards race right now. You know, we saw that with the race report under Boris Johnson. And I think a lot of people of colour hearing that will sort of think, well, I'm not sure it means much coming from a party with your policies.
I wonder, actually, your point about the way that he became Prime Minister is so important. He basically became Prime Minister as a result of a farce rather than a national
but
collective.
But also, literally, when it was put to the grassroots, he didn't win. And a lot of people thought that might be because of race. So, you know, it seemed particularly ironic to stand up and say, here I am as evidence that that's not a thing.
And Matthew, you've written about his speech in the paper today, using some words we can't use on the radio. Which we won't repeat.
No, we won't.
I love columns like that.
Yeah.
Yes. No, I thought the speech went well. It did its job in conference hall terms, and I thought he came over as more likeable than unlikable. I don't think anybody is going to like him less because of this speech, and some people might have thought, I'll give him a second hearing. But the actual content of the speech, he says long term. Long term is another word for jam tomorrow, basically.
And
these things are not going to happen.
And actually, long term is quite difficult when you've already been, or your party's been in power for the long term.
Yes, yes.
And you're promising that, well, we are going to sort those things out
now,
later.
Yes.
Not now, but later on.
Yes.
Embarking on, you know, the whole point of Michael Gove and his GCSE reforms was he thought about them in opposition, pushed on from day one in government, and only now are we seeing students sort of taking them. The idea of an A-level reform being something you would unveil at the end of your time in government does seem slightly ambitious.
It is difficult, though, if you're a party leader in a conference. Your Prime Minister, the election is about a year away, and you are not the favourite to win the election. It's quite difficult to talk plausibly and persuasively about the long term. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah.
All while also sort of billing yourself as the big change candidate,
yes,
which I thought
yes.
That was the most uncomfortable part of it. And he was so desperate to row back from everything that had come before that at one point he even sort of seemed to talk about himself as, this is the sort of Prime Minister I will be. And you felt like saying, like, you already
are. You
know? It's all about who he will be in the future versus who he has been and who everybody he has worked with has been.
And given you know, the anger over HS2, riling up your predecessors, to end up in a situation where all of your predecessors, I think Liz Truss likes the idea of cancelling HS2, but Theresa May, David Cameron and Boris Johnson are very rarely on the same side on anything. But they've criticised him over this.
Oh, it's such a
to
mess.
To get to a position where they come out publicly to say that, I mean, that contravenes so many sort of gentlemen's agreements.
Yeah, and he didn't get the tone right on cutting the next stage of HS2. The tone should have been, London to Birmingham is great. We're going ahead with it. It will be, it's more or less on course. It's going to make a huge difference. Fantastic. Unfortunately, we cannot afford the next stage. So we'll just concentrate on London to Birmingham. That would have been fine. But he actually trashed the whole idea of high-speed trains. He said that, you know, it isn't about city to city any longer. People go on buses and it isn't about London any longer, which in a sense leaves the first part of HS2, which is going ahead, feeling that it has not the love of the government or the Prime Minister.
So it's a good point that if he just said, I'm going to bank all that money because I'm not going to bankrupt the country, fine. But he's just promised to spend it in a load of other places.
Yeah, in undefined, nobody quite knows how that's going to work.
Well, there's a map and there's lots of things on the map that they're going to do.
Some of the things they said they were going to do and then they said they weren't going to do and said they are going to do. So the idea of reaping any political benefit for putting back on the table something you took off it is unlikely. Right, let's go back to the beginning of Rishi Sunak's speech now and that big introduction.
There's been a lot about Rishi in the media, about who he is, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what motivates him, and so forth. Now, some of it is accurate. I'm afraid he does love a good rom-com. The cheesier, the better, even. And some of it is not so true. So you'll be relieved to hear that episodes of Emily in Paris are not informing his outlook on the EU.
That was Akshata Murty, the Prime Minister's wife, introducing him for his conference speech yesterday. Is that a good idea? How much should we see or indeed hear from political spouses? Well, Baroness Kate Full knows all about that. She was David Cameron's Deputy Chief of Staff when he was in Number 10 and joins us now. Hi, Kate.
Hi, morning, Matt.
Tell us about the conversations that you had about David Cameron and Samantha Cameron. And I don't think she ever spoke at party conference, but there was always the debate about going up on stage afterwards. And is it demeaning? Is it better pictures? What was the conversation you were having?
Well, first of all, I remember the Sarah Brown introduction of Gordon Brown and her going, oh, no, that doesn't mean I have to do it. So that was quite interesting. On the whole, I mean, look, it's a difficult role being politician's wife, especially a premier's wife. There's a bit of let's see enough so you feel you see the support and the reassurance, and let's not hear too much from them. So you've got to strike that balance. But in the particular case of yesterday, look, I thought Atrato was very poised and graceful. I think the content was good. She was hammering home the sort of values, what makes Rishi tick. And, you know, we don't know Rishi that well. He hasn't been prime minister for that long. So I think the role for her yesterday was just to show a bit more of, him as a family man, his values, that sort of thing. So that's why they went for it, I think.
Yeah, so it was in 2008 and 2009 that Sarah Brown introduced Gordon Brown.
Yeah.
And then he lost the election. Did it work for you, Manfred?
Well, I think like Sarah Brown, there was something very humanising about it. You know, we were saying earlier that there's something quite robotic about the way Rishi Sunak normally speaks. And suddenly here was somebody that showed he had a bit of hinterland. Maybe he could have a laugh in another context. I also thought it was very smart because, you know, she's now being talked of as his secret weapon in the next election, whereas she would have been a massive problem in the next election if everyone had been talking about non-dom status and how rich she is. So, you know, I thought it was very smart in one move to sort of change the narrative.
The counter-argument is, now if Labour go after her on non-doms in the election,
they
can't say...
Privacy.
Privacy is, you know, it's about me, not about my wife, because she's now a political property, Matthew.
Yeah, she is. But I just liked it. I thought it was it was sweet. She came across as a nice person. I feel curious. A lot of people must feel curious as to what Rishi Sunak's wife is like, and we got a good sense of her. I've been reading Times readers' comments underneath columns, and I've noticed that women have reacted more against Akshata's appearance than men.
That's interesting.
I don't know why, but perhaps they feel she was being used in some way.
I thought it was a bit long. That would be my only complaint.
Yes, it was.
I think
it would
be kind of hard.
Yeah.
I think for women, though, it's probably just that thing of you're wheeling out a woman to make him look like he has a sense of humour.
Yeah. Kate, the other thing that struck me...
better that she's...
Sorry, go on.
I was just about to say, I think sort of better in a way that she spoke. I mean, the conversations we always used to have was exactly to that point, you know, is it a bit unfeminist to go and just stand on stage and wave like you couldn't open your mouth? So actually, in some ways, I'm surprised it was a sort of bit of a backlash, because I think, you know, it was good to hear from her.
The other thing that struck me is that on Instagram, where she posts all the time when she's been to events and hosted people in town, she's got 243,000 followers. And it's all been built up sort of slightly under... She does this thing as well called Lessons at 10, where she takes schools into number 10. And they don't talk about it publicly. It's just sort of going on. And she's clearly built up, you know, a reasonable sort of online presence as well. And maybe that's something they're going to try and unleash a bit, you know, basically quietly build it up and then use it in the election campaign.
Well, that's sort of what Carrie Johnson seems to have done for influence reasons, I think, separately.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, we on national radio say under the radar.
Yeah.
It's under our radio.
Exactly. It's not other people's radar.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what difference it makes. Kate, really good to speak to you. Thanks for that. That's Kate Ford, former Deputy Chief of Staff to David Cameron. And massive thanks to Matthew Paris and Manvi Rana. Top marks to Manvi for bringing in the cake. Look forward to the Bakewell pudding next week. Manveen Rana with Matthew Paris there. Of course, you can listen to Manveen on the Stories of Our Times podcast, wherever you get your podcast from, and read Matthew and the Times. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is the Old War Office.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
For as long as I've worked in and around Whitehall, this building has been behind hoardings and scaffolding. And to my left, I can see up to Trafalgar Square. To my right, down towards the Houses of Parliament. Behind me, you've got the home of the Household Cavalry and Horse Guards Parade, and you can see the guards on their horses. But in front of me, it is an incredible building, which has undergone an incredible transformation. Now, back in 1906, it was the War Office, from where then the First and Second World Wars were fought. It was the birthplace of the Secret Services. It played host to the likes of Winston Churchill, Lawrence of Arabia, Lord Kitchener and his famous Your Country Needs You campaign. John Profumo, when he wasn't off having an affair. And even Ian Fleming popped in from time to time and got inspiration for James Bond. Well, now, after 8 years and more than £1 billion, the old War Office is now the OO. It's home to a Raffles Hotel, a swimming pool, a ballroom, several bars and restaurants too. So you could stay in the room where the course of so many conflicts was decided. You might need to save up though. So let's go in and take a look.
And wow, as we walk in, there's an amazing staircase laid out in front of us, some pillars and arches, and I don't really know where to start, but luckily Fiona Harris, the in-house history expert of the building, is here. Hello, Fiona.
Hello,
welcome,
Matt.
To Times Radio. Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Explain what this building is. What can we see in front of us, and how long has it been here?
Well, Matt, you've just walked in the doors of what was the old War Office, now fondly known as the OWO. This building was closed to the public. It was the administrative headquarters for the British Army since 1906. So for the first time, this building has been restored by a family called the Hinduja family, and it's now open to the public. It's a hotel, it's 9 restaurants and 3 bars.
Wow.
So it's a huge destination.
And say what you like about the British Army, they knew how to do a grand building.
They did. They certainly did. This is Edwardian Baroque in style.
Baroque's definitely the word. There's sort of twiddly bits on every possible surface.
There are. And you've got, what I love, being a Dorset girl, is you've got Portland stone on the outside of the building.
Yep.
So there's something like 26,000 tonnes of Portland stone when this was originally built. 25 million bricks.
Wow.
And the architect, original architect, was William Young, a Scottish gentleman from Paisley. And his son Clyde took over the building of it when he died in 1901. It opened with a great fanfare. Edward VII was the monarch at the time. And of course, it was just before the sort of World War I period. So it had about 2,500 army men and women in this building, rising to around about 3,000 during World War I. 2.5 miles of corridors.
Wow, we're not going to walk all of them today, are we?
Well, how fit are you feeling?
Definitely not in half an hour. Well, let's go in then. Let's go and explore. Let's find out some history of this amazing building.
Of course. So you've got amazing columns and pillars here. Italian marble, English alabaster, which sometimes if you shine a torchlight behind the alabaster, it's
this is
luminous.
On the going up the stairs.
This is the balustrade of the grand staircase. So we're actually just on the foot of the grand staircase. This leads straight up to the second floor. So if you were the Secretary of State for War, as it was then called, now of course it's the Secretary of State for Defence, you would go up to your office, which we'll go to in a minute.
This looks like the set of The Crown.
It is
It's an amazing sort of, you know, a staircase which splits and goes in different directions. There's a golden clock at the top, the red carpet. I feel like
You feel like royalty, don't you?
You do feel a bit like royalty.
You do. And I think in Edwardian times, staircases like this were designed to impress and inspire people. If you think of a lot of the buildings of that era, they are grand, especially the ones on Whitehall and this part of London.
And I suppose the period we're talking about, early 20th century, still clinging on to the idea of empire will be not in the way that it was.
No, I think you have to look at it through
this was
the
from here. This is a place we ruled the world from.
Yeah, and you look at it through the filter of that period of time. This was the height of the British Empire. You've got amazing ceilings with plaster work. I gather there was a gentleman called James and Anne who was a plasterer from Scotland, and apparently the detail he went to create these moulded ceilings was intense. He didn't want to sit down for lunch because if he sat down at lunchtime, he said he might not get up again. He would be too stiff to carry on the plaster work.
So as we go up the stairs then, just give us a sense of the people who've walked up this staircase.
So originally, one of the first people would have been Lord Haldane. He was the first Secretary of State for Defence, and his office was here in 1906 when the building opened. And then, of course, you had greats like Lloyd George, Profumo, although you might not call him a great, but we
he's certainly someone we've heard of.
We like the film, don't we?
Yeah.
And then, of course, Churchill, who was Secretary of State for War, and latterly our Prime Minister, but they would have all come up these stairs. So it's a powerful address and a building which probably in many ways shaped our lives today.
I've just realised, coming about, I've been so focused on the staircase, this enormous chandelier hanging from this incredible ceiling.
It's beautiful. This is a new addition. This wasn't here when the military were here. It was hung a few months ago, and it's by a company called Idoghi, who are based in Venice, and it's obviously beautiful Venetian crystal. It's called Merides, and it's got two sort of huge glass orbs with, I think, 96 different bulbs, and it hangs from a grand dome, and in the dome, which has been the boards have come off, the light is now cascading through this beautiful glass atrium. You've got the ER insignia up there, which is Edward VII, because he was the reigning monarch when this building opened in 1906. You've got the Tudor rose, you've got the crown, so it is grand in the extreme. But the nice thing is, with this beautiful carpet, red carpet, which is wasn't there when the army men and women were coming up the stairs, it sort of gives it a comfort. It's comforting on your feet as you walk around the building, and it actually sort of envelops you and makes you feel actually quite warm.
It's quite cosy, despite being this enormous sort of atrium.
Yes.
Fabulous. Where are we going next?
We're going to go to the Haldane suite.
Lovely. Got big, heavy-duty wooden doors. Wow, so this looks like what I imagine it looked like, 50, 100 years ago?
You're not far off it, Matt. This is the Haldane suite, so the office of the Secretary of State for War, Lord Haldane being the first one. It overlooks Whitehall, and in fact we're right opposite the Household Cavalry and what are the official gates to Buckingham Palace. So incredible views out of this window if we just walk up to them. And you can hear the bell chime every hour from the clock above the entrance to the Household Cavalry. You've got beautiful marble fireplaces, which came actually from the original army offices on Pall Mall. So they were bought in by the architect of the time, William Young, to put in here. I think there are around about 37 unique fireplaces here made of marble, which are very special. It's got wood panelling, which I'm told when Profumo was Secretary of State for War, his wife decided she didn't like the rather male oak panelling, so she painted it Wedgwood blue. It has now been restored to its beautiful former glory as wood.
Wow. Who'd have thought you could do that? You could just move into a government building and get the paint pot out.
Well, obviously, Lady Profumo had her way.
Yes.
And we've got a high ceiling here. It's about 10.5 metres. Again, beautiful plaster work. And chandeliers that have been hung and restored. There's a company called Madsen Black, who I think are based in Oxfordshire. And the great-great-great-grandfather was a chandelier maker and manufacturer. And he put in many of the original chandeliers in this building.
They've managed to go
and
back and
did the Admiralty and some in Buckingham Palace too.
Amazing. And there's an enormous desk here. Is that where the Secretary of State for War would have sat?
Yes, this is an old partner's desk, and it's positioned where the Secretary of State for War would have sat. It's also positioned where Churchill would have sat when he was Secretary of State for War. And of course, he would have been in and out of this room throughout his career in politics. The Secretary of State for War would have had this office. He would have had the Secretary of State for War's conference room, which is opposite the other side of the staircase we walked up, which is now called the Raffles Suite. And then along this frontage, the frontage of the building, overlooking Whitehall, you can actually take up to six rooms interconnecting as a suite. So that gives anyone the most amazing address, as it were, temporarily, to be in London and look over Whitehall.
And just hypothetically, if I thought I wanted a long weekend to bring my friends, how much would all that cost?
So if you want, our rooms start from 1,100, and then they go up from that.
Yeah.
So have a little look-see. It's a special occasion, isn't it?
Very much so. Very special.
But equally, you might just want to come for a nice drink, a lunch or a coffee.
But what an amazing place full of history.
It is.
The people who sat here and the decisions made.
Do you know, that's the key word. I actually think this building is humbling because some of the decisions that were made here have probably changed the course of all of our personal lives because they were the big decisions of the 20th century. And some quite interesting secret decisions, because in 1909, there was a meeting with the SSB, the Secret Service Bureau, and Mansfield Cumming, who was head of that at the time and was latterly the inspiration for M in the Bond books, he pulled a meeting together to look at the original formation of MI5 and MI6. So they had their original offices here.
And they were born in this building.
Born in this building.
Fabulous. Where are we going next?
Shall we try the Churchill suite?
Yes, that's what we're here for. And how much, as we walk down the corridor, how much of what went on here is still secret?
I think a lot of the documents are now in the public domain. Yeah. So I can't speak for MI5 and MI6, of course. But, you know, there's a lot of history that one can read. I know Jeff Hoon, our former Secretary of State for Defence, wrote a really interesting history on this building, actually, which is available to anybody online, which really looks back at this site right the way back to Tudor times, in fact, pre-Tudor times, because we're sort of standing where originally York Palace would have been, the Archbishop of York, pre the days of Henry VIII. And then if you roll around the period of Henry VIII, then this was where he had his Palace of Whitehall, which was actually a 27-acre site, so we're within the footprint of that. Most of the Palace of Whitehall burnt down in a fire in 1698, Banqueting House being one of the few remaining structures. So within the square footage of this building, Henry VIII would have lived, ate, slept and passed away. He's obviously buried at Windsor now.
And I suppose that's just a reminder that the seat of power, whether that's kings and queens or prime ministers or Secretaries of State for War, has been within this small part of London for such a long time.
It's been a seat of monarchy, it's been a seat of government administration.
Oh, come on, let's see if we can get into the Churchill suite.
Okay. It's a bit of a walk, because don't forget we've got 2.5 miles of corridors. And I'm going to introduce you at this point to the wonderful Emil, who is our expert.
Emil, lovely to see you.
Mr. Chorley, very
good
nice
good to see
meet
you. Thank you very much. You're going to tell us all about the Churchill suite. I mean, it's spectacular. Well, I don't really know where to begin. Just tell me what I'm looking at and how significant it all is.
So for me, and I think for a lot of historians as well, this would have been the nerve center of the building. So the most important room out of the entire site. It's been very much restored the way it used to be. Of course, it's missing a lot of the martial decorations that would have been back in the day here. For example, the whole room would have been strewn with maps. There would have been flags of the regiments of the British Army hang on the wall in order of precedence. And of course, now we have a very nice meeting table in the center of the room. But back then, the table would have spanned the room from one end, so one fireplace all the way to the other.
And who is sitting at those tables? And what are the meetings that they're having?
So that would have been the members of the Army Council and sometimes officers as well who were called in to brief. For example, a very funny story actually. In the First World War, there was an officer in charge of the Department of Information, how to convey messages from the front to the back lines. And he was called in to brief about the use of carrier pigeons. But because there was always a kind of like sense of severity in this room, because some serious subjects were discussed here, he wanted to alleviate the situation a bit, introduce some laughter by making a joke. So he said, like, why don't we cross the carrier pigeons with parrots So we can give them the report, they'll fly in and do the report themselves. The joke didn't really work because he got thrown out of the room. So the people sitting here would have been the big wigs of the British Army. So the Quartermaster General, Master General of Ordnance, the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, sometimes the Secretary of State of War would come as well, although he was a busy man, so he would not always be here. But the main subjects that were discussed, as I said, how to convey messages from the front to the back lines, where to attack, how to set up a campaign, how many troops will we need, will we set up some fortifications. So the whole conduct of a certain conflict, or even in peacetime, how to organize the army and so on. And for example, even in 1909, the creation of the secret services would have all been discussed and made in this room.
It's incredible. And I suppose part of me is thinking about anyone who's been to the Somme or, you know, some of the trenches and in France and so on. If you're in this room making those decisions, you're so far removed from, you know, what an amazing, you know, high ceilings and wood panelling and chandeliers and thick carpets, just a million miles away from what it was like on that front line, moving people around on a map. You know, you're a long way from the dirty business of war.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't say there's a sort of detachment from those officials back then, because a lot of them were actually, especially during the First World War, officers that come back out of retirement, because everybody who used to work here before the war, and for example in the interwar period after the First World War, you know, would have been called to the front. So during the war, it was a lot of ex-officers here who knew what it was like to be on campaign. So they didn't not just move little pieces of wood on the map.
Or they knew what they knew what exactly. What coupled, I mean, it's an amazing hotel, but to be thinking about what went on here, the decisions and the drama and the secrets and all that.
Exactly. So, I mean, like I said, back in the day, there would have been a very heavy atmosphere here, maybe, not a lot of laughter and so on. So nowadays, we kind of changed it a little bit. It went from a martial atmosphere to more a designer atmosphere. And we hope there will be more laughter and, you know, reunions and so on in here. Except of just, you know, very heavy talk about how to change the world, basically. So.
More jokes about parrots.
Exactly, yeah, definitely.
Emil, thank you so much for showing us the
room. No problem
at all. Fantastic, good to see you.
I hope you enjoyed it.
So where are we now? You've brought me to another grand room.
I
get the feeling there are no bad rooms.
Nope, there
yet another, you know, it's just yet another high-ceiling, chandeliered, wood-panelled room overlooking ancient buildings in Westminster.
But it's named after rather a special lady.
Go on.
It's named after Christine Granville. So we call this the Granville Suite. So Christine Granville was Polish. She was an aristocrat and she became a spy during the Second World War. There's rumours that she was Churchill's favourite spy. There's rumours she had an affair with Ian Fleming. She was quite a lady. And in fact, there's a book called The Spy Who Loved by a really good historian called Claire Mully, which is worth reading. And that tells you all about her life.
So when you talk about her being a spy, where was she?
Well, she was collecting intelligence for the Allies. And there are rumours that she used to ski across the border out of enemy territory with documents secreted into her gloves so she could get through enemy lines with information that was really essential to help us move forward and win the Second World War.
And I suppose that's just a reminder that pre-digital communication, if you want, actually the most secure way of passing on intelligence was to do it physically.
Absolutely. Original source documentation.
Yeah.
So nothing could be AI manipulated.
Absolutely.
It was original source.
And all hidden in our gloves. Amazing.
We feel that it's quite nice to make a special feature out of some of the women that worked behind the scenes during the Second World War. So this is one of those suites, and we've got a range of other suites named after female spies like Christian Lamb or the Nairn sisters or Vera Atkins.
And that's because it's quite easy to do your Churchills and your, you know, the Haldanes and the men who are running the show.
Yes.
Sitting at the big
bit
table
of girl
making
power.
Yes, but behind the scenes there were women involved
a
and
lot.
Actually
and in front of the scenes.
And get written out of the history sometimes.
Exactly. So we are making sure that we sing from the rooftops about all the women who played their part during the 20th century. So this is one special lady and one very special suite.
Now, we're standing in the bedroom, which is enormous and very grand with a four-poster bed.
Interestingly, this was originally the levee rooms. And were in a room which would have had a conference table where SIGS, or Chief of the Imperial General Staff, would sit at the head of it. It would have been a V-shaped conference table because the theory was if he sits at the head, he can look at everybody in the eyeballs and work out whether they're trustworthy or not. Where there's a bathroom, there's a rather beautiful bathtub, huge oversized shower. That's where his office was. So that's where you go to either be court-martialed or promoted. But wow. Now, where his desk is, there is a beautiful copper bath.
That looks incredible. Oh my goodness. So normally you'd come in here with some trepidation.
You would.
If you were in trouble.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
But now it's enormous. The ceilings here are around about 10.5 metres.
Yeah.
And you've got a beautiful copper bathtub, huge shower and loo.
Is this the shower in here?
Yes.
Wow. I think I've lived in flats smaller than that. That's incredible.
It's very special. It's like having, I guess, a rain shower in a forest.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Where have we come up to? This is an amazing view.
We've come up to the fifth floor, and we're now in what's called the turret suite, with views right down over the House of Cavalry, the parade ground, down over St James's Park, to Buckingham Palace.
Buckingham Palace, out of one window, but that's not all.
That's not all.
So we walk round, an amazing view of Big Ben. Down Whitehall, see the Houses of Parliament, the gates of Downing Street, the Cenotaph. This is where, on one of these buildings, this is in, there's a Bond film, isn't there? That he appears on the roof of a building.
This, absolutely, Skyfall.
Yes, Skyfall.
In fact, scenes from 5 Bond movies have been filmed in or around this building. So it's got a real legacy with that Bond.
Let's have a look, see what's out this side. Well, from there, so that's the Ministry of Defence and the London Eye. And then looking across the river though, isn't it? So that's the old Shell building.
Absolutely, yeah. And you're looking to the London Eye and you've got Whitehall Court and all the beautiful apartments that were built just before this building.
And then back over that way then, you're looking up towards Trafalgar Square and Nelson's Column.
Completely. And another fun fact I love is that the Household Cavalry Parade Ground, where Trooping of the Colour takes place, back in the day of Henry VIII, that used to be what was called the Tilt Yard, and that's where all the jousting took place.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You had a good view of it from up here.
So but you'd have a very good view if this had been built then.
Well, what an amazing way to end our little tour. Just a reminder of, you know, you've got Buckingham Palace in that direction, Parliament in that direction, Trafalgar Square in that direction, the Ministry of Defence as it is now. Just a reminder of what sort of central spot this has been in the history of the country.
In the history of the country, and never been open to the public.
Yeah.
And now for the first time, open to the public, so everybody can come and enjoy it and see London from a perspective that they've never seen
before.
Yes,
that's so true. I feel like I've seen Big Ben from most angles, but now I've seen it from a new one.
A new one,
yeah, fantastic.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Fiona, for giving us a tour of the OWO.
And Raffles London.
And Raffles London. A fantastic location, right smack dab.
Our pleasure. Come back again.
We will do.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Catch me on Times Radio from 10, Monday to Friday. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.